Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, and it's time for our roundtable discussion about Wisconsin wildlife and natural resources. And our regular guest back with us for that, three of them, Pat Durkin, one of them, freelance writer and editor and president of the Wisconsin Outdoor Communicators Association. Pat, welcome back.
Thanks, Larry. It's always good to join you.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. Dean Bortz is editor of Wisconsin Outdoor News. And Dean, good to have you back with us. I guess you can still do some ice fishing up where you live.
Yeah. Excuse me, sorry about that. A little bit of a cough. But yeah, I know there were guys out on the ice on Lake Minocqua yesterday yet.
Oh, man. Well, it's great to have you back. Tim Isley with me in the studio, freelance outdoor writer, private landowner in Crawford County. And Tim, it's great to have you back as well.
Thank you, Larry. Wonderful to be here. And April is here. Good time to be outdoors. Thank you.
Great time to be outdoors. And as we talk with our experts, I hope you'll join in. Maybe share your thoughts on wildlife conservation in our state. Maybe have some questions about rules and regulations, or maybe just a comment. I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. We have a new DNR secretary in late December. Governor Evers appointed Karen Huhn as DNR secretary. She took office a month later. It's pretty important, Pat, to have that position filled after it was vacant for more than a year.
Yeah, I was happy to see that, and I it'll be interesting to see where we go from here. You know, with any kind of DNR appointment for that secretary job, you'll always see some people unhappy with the choice and whatever. And I guess my position is always you wait and see how they go and hope for the best, but this woman seems like she's very qualified for the job.
She does indeed. Tim, how valuable for Wisconsin is to have a DNR secretary?
Oh, Larry, it's just incredibly valuable. I mean, this is the person who leads the agency and is the spokesperson and the cheerleader for the DNR, and you need that, especially with the legislature. And I think one of the things that she needs to do as far as her first job, she needs to establish a rapport with the legislature on behalf of the DNR. And it was interesting because I was up at the Natural Resources Board meeting this morning, and they gave her a chance to give a little bit of a report on her last month. And she indicated she has been talking to the legislators and meeting with them. And I asked Adam Payne, who used to be the last permanent secretary of the DNR, and I asked Adam, I said, how important is it that, what is some of the things she needs to do? And he agreed that she needs to not only talk to the legislators, but he said she needs to focus on getting to know the members of the Joint Finance Committee, because these are the people who are going to be putting together the budget. And it's just so important. When Adam Payne was secretary, he had a very good report, and they did a lot of good things. They got some significant increases for state parks and some of the payment for wardens. So that is a key thing, and that's something that she needs to do. But I'm so impressed with her background, all the agencies she's worked for, and the knowledge she's got. I think she's going to be really good. We'll wait and see.
Yeah, wait and see. Dean, on your from your point of view, what do you think? What are her priorities? I like what Tim had to say about the meetings. When you think about natural resource issues, what do you see as a top on the list, maybe?
Well, you look at the timing of her appointment between now and the end of June. I mean, we're looking at the new budget. And so probably her and Governor Evers proposed license fee increases. So between now and then, I'm thinking she's going to be very busy working through the budget with staff, and then, as Pat and Tim mentioned, working with legislators and the Joint Finance Committee just to see where this is going to go.
Yeah.
And then what I'd like to see after that would be if Karen gets a chance, set up some meetings around the state, you know, just to stick her nose out a little bit, let people get to know her and see her and hear what she has to say. I know a lot of people are questioning her hunting, fishing, and trapping background, So if she gets out and moves around the state a little bit, you know, maybe we get to know her a little bit better.
Yeah, I think that's a very, very good point. Dean, what do you think about the hike in the license fees?
You know, we need one, no question about it. To me, the increases that have been offered seem a little bit arbitrary as far as how, I don't know how they came about them. But what I'd like to have seen would be the governor's office working with the Conservation Congress or maybe Rob Staffel's, you know, Senator Staffel's group. Senator Staffel's said he couldn't support an increase until he saw more about what the DNR budget looks like and where spending goes. I really think we should have had some sort of a group working together on this to come up with a plan. And, you know, hopefully we get some sort of an increase, whether it's the governor's or it's the legislature's. I don't know, but we do need an increase.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. Let's take another topic while we're on it here, turkey hunting, because that's coming up pretty quickly. April 16th is the opening day for the spring turkey hunting season. Tim, you've got a long history. Well, all of us, I think, listening have a pretty long history. Yours may be the longest when it comes to that. Give us a little history on the...
Well, thanks, Larry. Yeah, well, I think Pat and Dean are right there right with me, but turkey hunting is so interesting because growing up here in Wisconsin, we didn't have wild turkeys. I mean, they were here way back when, and then they were A, shot off, B, people cut down the woods. And so where turkeys used to be in a line roughly from Prairie du Chien up to Green Bay, south of that, you know, for a long time, then we never had them. And then the DNR started bringing turkeys back in, and they had made one attempt, which was to bring in birds from Pennsylvania, which had they were half wild and half domestic, and that was a problem. They were released up around Nisida, and those birds just didn't survive. They didn't have the 100% wild strain. So then what the DNR did is that they traded the state of Missouri. Wisconsin trapped three rough grouse and sent them to Missouri for every one wild turkey trapped in the wild in Missouri and sent them up here to Wisconsin. And back during the 1970s, I had worked for the DNR, and so in about 1977 or 78, I was up in Eau Claire, and that's when the second shipment of turkeys came in, and we met the Missouri Conservation Department plane, I think outside of Durand, and out of the plane come these boxes with wild turkeys in them. And then they went, and the people who worked on this, Bob Cochran, Ron Nicholas, John Nelson, these people were so good, and the DNR people, they put together a whole program. So then they checked those turkeys out, they took blood samples, put tags on them, and then they released them. And those turkeys that they released, you know, then all over the western part of the state grew and grew. And then they trapped some and live trapped them and took them further east. So now we've got them throughout the state. But I started hunting, I think it was in 1984, because last year I was fortunate to get a bird. And I was sort of sitting there thinking about it, you know, this is my 40th year of turkey hunting. And to have that opportunity to be out in the woods, to hear the birds sing in the morning, and just to be there, and the turkeys. I mean, when a gobbler is coming in strutting and sticks its head out and gobble, 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 and pulls the head back and then struts, it is amazing. That white head just glows. It's a wonderful opportunity, and we are so fortunate to have it. And the fact that the department has got the zones and we've got the permits, time periods, it spreads the pressure out, so that you don't have a really heavy hunting pressure like you do in some other states. It's a quality hunt. And I'm so privileged to have participated, and Dean and Pat, I'm sure, feel the same way.
Yeah, I would bet so. We got a lot of turkeys living in residential areas now. and, of course, they're not hunted. Any problems? Somebody wondered about that. Any problems with that?
Well, I think they've had some problems with chasing some mail carriers, and sometimes with really young kids have been a little bit apprehensive about it. So we do have a lot of them here in Madison, and but I don't know that they cause any damage at all, but there's quite a few of them.
Robin in Minneapolis emailed to say they read on Facebook that Dean Bortz is advocating for the release of dire wolves in northern Wisconsin. Is that true, Dean?
Why not?
Are you familiar with the story about dire wolves?
I've spent probably 4 hours reading any scientific paper I could on dire wolves yesterday, and some of them weren't even scientific papers. They were just, you know, press releases from Colossal, whatever they are, Biospheres or whatever their name is. But they can claim that they've resurrected the dire wolves all they want, but they have not. The problem is going to be a lot of people are going to buy the information that Colossal is spreading instead of reading the background on it. And it's just unfortunate they're presenting it the way they are, because these are not dire wolves.
Yeah.
And I don't know if Tim and Pat have read anything on it, but yeah, it's just not. They're not dire wolves.
It's Colossal Biosciences, and this is the birth of three genetically engineered wolf pups. Pat, are you familiar?
Yeah, I think one of my best friends, most knowledgeable friends I have, is a guy named Jim Heffelfinger. He's a University of Wisconsin Stevens Point graduate. He's now a professor, researcher out in Arizona. And as soon as this came out, Jim put together a response kind of letting people know that these are not dire wolves. They have apparently just little bitty tiny aspects of the dire wolf genes in them, but just enough to give them a little different look and coloration. But Jim was, I could just tell by his post that he was not happy that this is being put out there as the rebirth of the dire wolf.
Yeah, they're supposedly striking white fur and so forth. And I think there was a movie or a series of movies that involved dire wolves, and maybe that's why they were trying to do it.
They had dire wolves in Game of Thrones.
Game of Thrones. Okay.
Yeah.
I wasn't a Game of Thrones person, so I wasn't sure. Ron in Weyerhaeuser has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Ron.
Yeah, hi, Larry. I just wanted to give a shout out to your guests, Dean, for writing a great article, and for Pat and Tim giving their take on Bob Haas being the Wisconsin Outdoor News Conservationist of the Year. Very well deserved, and anybody that knows Bob knows he more than deserves it.
Yeah. Ron, thanks for calling. Comment, Tim, let's turn to you.
Yeah, well, of course, that was Dean's selection, and it was just 100% accurate. Bob is just one of the most outstanding sportsmen. As I say, he was the epitome of an outdoors person, well-rounded and a great photographer. But the things that he does, he puts on these photo programs for people in some of the assisted living facilities. The fishing things that he has helped out with, that he served on the Sporting Heritage Council. He's been on the Conservation Congress. This guy has done all sorts of good things. And right now, he, in fact, is also stumping, talking about the importance of a license fee increase that we really need in this state. And so he's going out and talking about that. He's just, it was a wonderful choice, and I compliment Dean on his choice.
Yeah, Dean, a comment?
Jim said a lot of it, but yeah, I mean, I guess what I'd say is for everything that Bob does, and he does a lot, we could give this award to probably 100 people a year and still not cover everybody. So I guess that's what I'd like to say, is that we have so many people like Bob who give of themselves, of their time, of their finances, volunteer in every direction, do so much over so many years. I don't know if it's like that in every other state or any other state, but for as long as I've been doing this, I've just been continually amazed at the people of Wisconsin who do so much for conservation, kids. It's just amazing, and Bob is an example of that.
talking all things in wildlife and the out-of-doors here in our state with our three guests today. Always great to have them come by. Our outdoor writers, Dean Bortz, editor of Wisconsin Outdoor News, Pat Durkin, freelance writer and editor and president of the Wisconsin Outdoor Communicators Association, and Tim Isley, freelance outdoor writer, private landowner in Crawford County, one of the founding members of the Wisconsin Outdoor Communicators Association. Questions for them? Give a call. The number's 800-642-1234. Or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at Wisconsin outdoors today and what's going on in the field of conservation and natural resources, our Outdoor Writers Roundtable group, we've been doing this a long time together. It's great to have them with us. Dean Bortz, editor of Wisconsin Outdoor News, Pat Durkin, freelance writer and editor, and Tim Isley, also a freelance outdoor writer and one of the founding members of the Wisconsin Outdoor Communicators Association. Questions or comments, give a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@WPR.org. Let's take a call from Jonah in Eau Claire next. Hi, Jonah. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi. What can we do as people that are, you know, in the biological, you know, environmentally minded sphere? What can we do to curb misinformation around these engineered wolves? It reminds me of the situation a number of years ago when the revival of mammoth was being talked about. But we'll never get that species back, right? Like, we can get close, but it's not the same thing, and that's an important distinction. What can we do to communicate that to people that are perhaps not as well-minded in this topic as we are?
Well, let's see. Who wants to take a shot at that? Tim, go ahead.
Well, thanks, Larry. One possibility is talking to communicators, talking to some of the people who are at the newspapers, in the radio stations, at the TV stations, the communicators to raise their awareness. You know, if some of those people are just taking information that's coming off of the announcement, they don't know the full part of the story. So one of the things is talking to communicators and talking to people, your local newspaper and radio TV stations, and getting them to be alert to that fact.
Pat, you want to join in?
Yeah. Well, the one thing I'd say, too, is that we can post the information out there. We can write about it, talk about whatever. But the one thing we know, unfortunately, is that these kind of things come and go. And I'm guessing 2 weeks from now, we won't be hearing a whole lot about it. And I read those things, and I just kind of laugh because I think, well, we're all upset. This is terrible. People aren't getting the real information. And then a few weeks goes by and we've kind of forgotten about it because there really was nothing there. And it just does not hold up to any kind of scrutiny over time. And so it quickly fades away usually.
Yeah. Yeah. Jan in Madison has something for us. Jan, hi.
Hi, good morning. As a former school forest naturalist, I've aged out of that because my body won't let me do it anymore. But my goal was to teach children, and the children of our state are one of the most important resources that we have in order to teach them about nature, how beautiful it is, how crazy it is at times, and how much we need to take care of it. And how the animals interact with each other, how the trees interact with each other. Those are educational tools that we can give those children. And I would encourage everybody to talk to the powers that be in the school system and the government of the state to allow more outdoor education for our children and youth in order to promote whatever, you know, that's where our future lies. If those kids grow up in the city with computers, I had a teacher tell to me one day, well, they can learn about nature on the computer. That doesn't cut it.
Jan, thank you very much for calling. Let's get a comment or two here. Dean, what about it?
Sure. Jan's right. What I know, I live in almost on the border of Vilo Sonata County, grew up in Ashland County, so I'm up north, and I'm on a local school board. Stephanie's a teacher, so I hear about this all the time. One thing that I've noticed, and I don't know how pervasive this is around the state, but most schools up here have a school forest. And they'll take kids out to these school forests regularly, not a ton in the winter, but spring and fall. And I know over the years of doing articles for Outdoor News that we've done a number of stories about other schools that have school forests. I know that's going on. And then we just talked about Bob, and thank you, Ron, for calling in and bringing that up. Bob deserves a more than just a little mention. But I know that Bob and Tim and Pat probably know this better than I do. Bob's involved with a group called MOHE. That's their acronym. I don't know what it stands for. But MOHE is coming up relatively soon. It used to be at the State Game Farm, but I think they moved it. And MOHE is an event that brings kids outdoors. And I think a lot of it is focused on fishing. But anything that goes along with clean water and producing fish and keeping fish, say, for instance, trout streams, keeping them vital and flowing. And so I know there's a lot going on already in the state. I just don't know if it's everywhere.
Yeah, or if it's enough, Tim.
Yeah, no, what she says is really true. And the school forests, I went to school here in Madison, and Paul Olson was the principal, and Paul is the one, I think, who started the Madison School Forest. But all those schools that have the school forests, there's places like Trees for Tomorrow up at Eagle River. It's so important, I think, to talk to the schools to try and encourage them to get the students to go to these places, not only the school forest, but places like Trees for Tomorrow, and they get a really good background up there. We've got, I think it's Victoria Reinberg, I believe, is the environmental person with the Department of Public Education in the state here, and she's doing a great job. It's so important to get kids outdoors. This caller was so correct, but it's worth talking to the teachers and trying to be sure that they get the kids outdoors and get them to some of these programs into the school forests.
Yeah. I was trying to think back to the Deer Hunt 2025. 2024 TV show that talked about a program for which is bringing kids out of Milwaukee to spend time in the outdoors and just get exposed. And a lot of the kids that were in that, as I recall, had not really spent any time.
Well, I know they have some good programs down there, but I think this MOHE is, I think Mark LaBarbera was instrumental in putting that together up at Poinette, and they have that each year in May, and they get all these school buses and all these kids that come in, and they get a whole big background on the outdoors. So that's a really good one, and for people that have children in school to get their teachers to go up there to participate in that and get up there to Poinette.
Jerry in Sun Prairie has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Jerry.
Well, I have two things. I have a comment about the first or the last caller about the school forest, and that back in the 60s, I was about a quarter short on my for my high school diploma and stuff like that. So they had a thing back then with Paul Olson and that. We worked on Mount Vernon Creek, put boom covers in. Us helped at the school forest, and for I think it was 4 weeks period in that, but you got a quarter point. I don't even know if that's going on anymore. And the other thing is, I'm a member of the Yahara Fisherman's Club in Madison, and we're celebrating our 80th anniversary this year for working with conservation as far as fishing. Twice a year we do kids fishing days, once in January and once in this year it's in May, and that we give 300 rods and reels out and let them go fishing. teach them about fishing.
Jerry, thanks so much. I know, Tim, you wanted to say something about that.
Well, I agree. The Hare Fishing Club is just a wonderful organization. And in fact, I'm working on an article on their 80th anniversary, which is coming up. I did an article back on their 50th anniversary a few years ago. But, you know, my grandfather used to take me out. They called it the Perchery, and it was on Lake Mendota. And during January, you'd go out there, and Lake Mendota was just covered by all of these ice fishermen out there who were catching perch. And so, you know, and they put that on, and it was a fundraiser, and they contribute to a lot of different good projects around the Madison area and on the lakes and teaching kids, and they do that every spring. So hats off to the Hare Fishing Club, and that anniversary should be a good one, and hope that more people will hear about it, you bet.
Yeah, absolutely. Pat, did you want to add too?
Yeah, we're on this topic. I wanted to share with you that, you know, 2 years ago, we have a high school teacher up in Superior named Lori Danz, who was named the National Educator of the Year award, you know, White House visit, all that kind of stuff. She won this award, and it was interesting to me when I wrote about her accomplishment, that she credits a lot of that success to her outdoor learning from her father. You know, she learned as a kid that her dad was a good instructor and taught her all the outdoors knowledge that she took into her profession as a high school biology teacher, and really did a wonderful job with that over the years, to the point where she got recognized as Wisconsin Teacher of the Year, and then represented Wisconsin out in Washington, D.C. for that accomplishment. So I just wanted to kind of give a little shout out that, you know, there are really good teachers in the state who go out of their way to bring kids into the outdoors and teach them how we all connect. And the quick story I always remember from my childhood in school forest was having a fourth grade teacher. Her name was Geraldine Gerald, young teacher, and she set it up to where the next time we got like a fresh coating of snow, like a 2-inch snowfall, she quick put together a school trip for our fourth grade classes out to the school forest to learn how to identify different animal tracks. And I thought, just that spur of the moment planning she did to make that work, I look back on it and think, you know, we have some teachers who really go out of their way to do their job for us.
Yeah, well said. Peggy Sue in Brilliant has something relating, I believe. Let's go there. Peggy Sue, hi.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have called in several times for different subjects, but this really rang a bell with me. I work at Fleet Farm in Appleton, and I have seen over the last 3 years, I have learned so much about fishing and everything, hunting. I had a young man come in yesterday with his daughter, bought a bunch of hunting stuff. He's taking her turkey hunting for the third year. I have just been amazed. I have to tell you, there are a lot of parents taking it into their own hands to get their kids out to fish and hunt. It just amazes me. It has amazed me over the last 3 years how many parents I've met. And he said that he tried to take his son, but his son's only 5 years old. And he said he can't sit still long enough to do it. But he said his daughter does a wonderful job. And I was just like, that's awesome. I mean, every time I talk to a parent that's doing this kind of thing, I tell them, you know, we really need to get some kind of class in school to get them going on this. Because I took my grandsons to the sturgeon fishing, or not fishing, but the sturgeon spawning last year at Shiocton. Their eyeballs were falling out on the ground.
Really good points. And Peggy Sue, and I would just add a personal comment on that. My daughter, when she was first old enough to do it, went through the hunter safety program. And we've spent many days turkey hunting. And the opportunity to be with your child or your children in a situation like that, where you're, before it's even light out, you're hearing the sounds of spring, you're seeing a fox or deer run by, and you have a chance to spend many hours alone with your child, and there's not a phone involved, anything like that. A chance to really spend that time is about as rewarding, I think, as it can get for a mother or a dad.
I certainly agree with you, Larry. And this, in fact, this weekend is the Youth Turkey Hunt coming up, starts on the 12th. And so that's a good opportunity for people to get out with their youngster. But that time alone with your parent, you can just develop such close relationships. It's a very important time. That's a great point.
Yeah. Peggy Sue, thank you so much for calling. I appreciate it very much. Jolie in Mozanee, what's on your mind?
Hi. I just wanted to give a shout-out to Mike McKenzie. He used to come to my classroom. He was he's now a retired DNR guy. But he used to come to my classroom every year, and he would bring pelts, and he would talk to the kids. It was a lot of hands-on, and I just love that, and the kids just love that. And he was very good at explaining everything about with wildlife and protection and what they should do. So I just wanted to say that.
Thank you very much, Mike McKenzie. And there were this is something that goes on. The DNR does a lot of this, if I'm not mistaken, Pat. Oh, in fact, I know I'm a member of the Hope Rod and Gun Club, and Harold Hetrick, who was the assistant chief game warden for the state of Wisconsin, would come every before the deer hunting season and go over the new rules and regulations and give just a most entertaining talk. And then afterwards, he'd sit down and play sheep's head with some of the guys. But there were, and I really admired him a lot. And he always got a good message across. He'd have some good stories, but always got a good message across. Pat, Dean, Pat.
Yeah, the thing I've always been impressed with Larry, and I get on this soapbox about talking about public service. And the thing that always struck me over my 40 plus year career now is I'd show up at various meetings and various invitations I'd get to come talk or whatever, and almost always there's a DNR person, usually a warden, sometimes a fisheries biologist, sometimes a wildlife biologist. And you think how many nights those people spend away from home, just meeting people like this, giving talks, reaching out to folks, answering their questions, and they aren't getting anything extra out of it. That's part of their job. They're expected to be there, but they don't sit there and typically file that under overtime work. They just keep showing up and spreading the word. So, we get talking about license fee increases, and the comment I often make is, these things don't happen by accident. The programs we have, the people we hire, they don't just show up and do it. They really have good structures surrounding them, good programs, and we get something for our money. So that's my little pitch, and shout out to all the DNR people over the years and other folks I meet who just keep showing up and doing their job and spreading the word to folks.
Yeah. And Jolie, thank you so much. Don in Madison has a kind of related, I think, there. Don, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. And I guess I'd like to just mention the unofficial slogan from Friends of the Lower Wisconsin Riverway, and that is "No Child Left Inside." And I think that's a good way to go about things. And also, thank you to Tim and your wife, Linda, from way back when my son was in the Boy Scout troop, and you two had a big influence on him, so you should get some sort of award for that.
Don, thanks a lot. Well, Timmy, you turned red there for a minute.
No. Thank you. The Boy Scout troop was a really good one, and the interesting things that they did. In fact, Sean, for his Eagle Scout badge, he worked on putting together half-log structures to put in Lake Mendota to help smallmouth bass spawning. And so that was one of the interesting things that the kids got involved in. and to try and improve the habitat for smallmouth bass. So Boy Scouts is a really good organization.
Yeah, Don, thanks much. Liz in Hudson has something, I think, related as well. Hi, Liz.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I'm just driving across Wisconsin listening to your show, and I just recently became aware of two great resources for educators. One is called the Wisconsin Climate Hub, which has some amazing activities, a lot of science and facts, and has all different K through 12 age and grade level curriculums on there. So the Wisconsin Climate Hub. And then the other one is the KEEP program out of UW-Stevens Point, K-E-E-P. They have a lot of STEM activities and environmental activities as well.
KEEP program out of UW-Stevens Point and the Wisconsin Climate Hub. There you go. You guys familiar with any of those, Dean?
No, I'm not familiar with either of those programs, but I'll take a look at them.
Yeah, absolutely. Maybe there's a story for you guys.
Yeah, there could well be. Yeah, we're always looking for stories.
Yeah. Liz, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Dana in Manitowoc, on to you.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just happened to catch you guys and got intrigued by the conversation about the school forest. So I live in Manitowoc, and the Manitowoc Public School District has a school forest. It's the Rahr West School Forest, and it is adjacent to Point Beach, to the state forest. One unique thing that we do is in sixth grade, our students go to overnight camp. So they go out to camp with their classes for two nights, 3 days at the school forest. And I'm always amazed to hear the stories coming back. And I'm always amazed at for how many kids that's their first time not only away from home, it's their first time, you know, away from Manitowoc, and certainly their first time in the woods. So, you know, shout out to all the districts that have school forests, invest in the school forest, and staff the school forest. So, you know, Wisconsin public school kids can continue to have amazing opportunities. And with that, whoever called in about the Eagle Scouts, there are tons of Girl Scouts and Boy Scouts who do their golden, you know, the Girl Scout Golden Awards, and then also their Eagle Scout projects out at the school forest. So, yeah, we can't invest enough in the outdoors for our kids. So thanks to all the educators out there and, you know, all the magic that happens outside of the classroom.
Dana, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Lots of, you know, we've had a number of calls, and it's makes you feel kind of good to know that there's a lot going on. It could be more. I guess there could be more. But to know that there's a lot of people out there through school forests and other means to get kids outdoors. We're looking at the outdoors today with our three guests, our roundtable group of Dean Bortz, editor of Wisconsin Outdoor News, Pat Durkin, freelance writer and editor and president of the Wisconsin Outdoor Communicators Association, and Tim Isley, freelance outdoor writer and private landowner in Crawford County and the founding member of the Wisconsin Outdoor Communicators Association. Questions, comments? I see we've got one about the return of cougars to Wisconsin. We'll take that up next, but right after I remind you that you are listening to WPR News. Thanks so much for joining in today on WPR News as we take a look at Wisconsin outdoors with our three writers and outdoor writers, as a matter of fact, and editors, Dean Bortz, Pat Durkin, and Tim Isley. Questions or comments or maybe an experience to share, the number 800-642-1234 or email to talk@wpr.org. Let's take a call from Brian in Madison next. Hi, Brian.
Hi, Larry and your guests. Thank you for taking my call today. And my comment was about cougars or mountain lions. And I had worked up around Lake Wisconsin on the Wisconsin River 25 years ago. And at the time, a number of the hunters and guys were reporting or sightings of mountain lions or cougars. And obviously with the long tail, and later on they started turning up on trail cams. And So during that time, the story was that these cougars were migrating from all the way from the South Dakota, the Black Hills, and passing through Wisconsin, I guess, to get to the cornfields of Illinois, which we all had a chuckle over that. And what are we acknowledging that they just passed through? Is that the case? Or are we seeing instances where they're actually discovering Wisconsin's a pretty nice place to live?
Well, Brian, Dean, I know you have written just recently about cougars in the state. You want to comment?
Sure. I'm going to start this off by saying I blame Travis Jervy for having cougars in Wisconsin. I don't know if anybody remembers Travis Jervy, but he was a reckless special teamers player for the Green Bay Packers. And while I was going to school in Green Bay, the story was that he had a pet cougar. And that him and other players, he'd recruit other players to go out to one of the parks on the west side of town and set up nets, and they chased deer into the nets, and they would, you know, kill a deer so that Travis could take it home and feed his mountain lion. And now, and then the law enforcement suggested he get rid of it. Now, I don't know how he got rid of it. I'm sure he didn't just release it. But anytime a cougar story comes up, I just blame Travis Jervy automatically for that. But no, we've had cougars in the state for quite a while. You know, nobody's trying to hide the fact. They're acknowledged. We have a range of about 4 to 6 confirmed sightings a year for what, the past at least 8 years, 9 years, maybe a little bit longer. Just recently we ran a story about two, and since then it's been found out there are actually 3 cougar cubs in the UP west of Ontonagon that were confirmed. And after the initial report of the 2 kittens or cubs being seen, a local trapper went out and did some tracking and found not a den, but like a nest where they had been holed up under a downed spruce tree. And there were some remnants of porcupine skins and a few other things there. And as the animals left that area, he was able to tell that there were 3 cubs, 3 separate tracks from cubs, along with an adult cat. So, yeah, they're around. And a lot of them are coming from the Dakotas, from eastern Wyoming, the Black Hills in eastern Wyoming. And, you know, they're young, usually young males who are looking for mates. And when they take off on that search, they can go a long, long ways, and some of them end up here.
Brian, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, let's turn to Kathy in Bayfield.
Hi there.
Hi, Kathy.
Hi, Larry. I just wanted to let everybody know that the Wisconsin Conservation Congress is holding spring hearings on Monday, April 14th. I'm not sure what all the times are in each county, but every county will be holding one of these. And if you want to express your opinions about, you know, how the DNR is doing things, what you'd like to see happen with wildlife, this is a great place for it. And you can only vote for delegates at the in-person hearing. Oh, also, there is a spring hearing questionnaire online that anybody can go on for 2 days and sign up for.
Kathy, thanks a lot for calling. We were definitely going to talk about that in some detail. Well, there were 74 items on the hearing list, and I had a list from that list that I wanted to talk about today. But before we do that, Pat, I know you wanted to say something about cougars.
Yeah. Thanks, Larry. This finding up in the UP is really fascinating because, you know, all the cougars that we've documented coming across from the Dakotas, whether it's Minnesota, Wisconsin, or Michigan, they've always been these young males. You know, it's always been males, and cougars, from what I understand, the females are much less much less apt to go off on a long walk. Typically, when they start dispersing, the females start dispersing, they typically don't move from their home area more than 30 miles. And so to me, it's really intriguing that we have no documented females, no documented breeding of cougars going on in the wild in Minnesota, which is, of course, a big state between us and the Dakotas. And yet we have one now showing up in the UP. So I think I'm not discounting it, but I think it's just really unusual that we'd somehow not have any record of cougars breeding, reproducing in Minnesota, in Wisconsin, yet we have one up in the UP now. So this is going to be really interesting to see how this plays out and if they can document the female and where she might be from, because it's, like I say, it caught me off guard. I was kind of surprised that this happened.
Really, really interesting. Well, the spring hearings, and we'll probably be spending some time on the spring hearings, Dean, maybe talk a bit about what happens at these hearings. They're held in every county.
Right. Yeah. So every one of the state's 72 counties has a spring hearing meeting the second Monday of every April. It used to be the first Monday of every April until we figured out. And at the time, I was an Oneida County delegate that. The first Monday in April is always the NCAA championship, and we were wondering why we weren't getting enough people or many people to the spring hearings, and so we shifted it to the second Monday in April, and that had to be back in the early 90s. I don't even remember when that was, but yeah, I mean, and there are five delegates elected from each county. There are usually at least two, sometimes three seats open each year. So in order to, like Kathy said, and I'm wondering if that's the Kathy that I know from Bayfield. And if she is, she should have stumped for Pat, because he's going to be running for election in Bayfield County. So anyway, as Tim and Pat, they could probably tell you more about this than I can, but I you know, the history of the Congress, it goes back to, I think, 1932. Pat, is it 1932 that it was founded?
I think it's around 31, 33, someplace in there, early 30s, yeah.
Yeah, so this has been, you know, this isn't something new. This has been going on for a long time. As far as I know, we're the only state that has any system like this. The Congress was created to provide input for sportsmen, a way for sportsmen to get their voice heard by the Natural Resources Board. Now it's the Natural Resources Board. Prior to that, it was a commission. And the DNR, prior to that, Wisconsin Conservation Department. And, you know, so we play a role in setting or determining what our either rules or regulations are going to be for hunting, fishing, and trapping. And it's a great way for people to get involved. You can write your own resolution. Mm-hmm. Now, it's too late this year to submit your own citizen resolution on a potential rule change or regulation change. They had to be submitted by, I think, middle of March or early March or maybe late February, but there's a process for us to write our own rules. And if they were supported locally, then in a year or two or three, they could potentially come up the chain on the DNR side of the agenda as a proposed rule change. So it's a pretty unique system.
It is indeed, and we'll talk some more about it and some of the rules that are being suggested for this year with our three guests, Dean Bortz, Pat Durkin, and Tim Isley. We will take a quick look at the news and find out what else is in store for us here on WPR News, and then we'll be back. I'm Larry Mueller. You can join in. Number's 800-642-1234 or email to talk@wpr.org. Thanks for joining us today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, taking a look at Wisconsin outdoors with our three guests who do a lot of writing about the outdoors and natural, the conservation of our natural resources. Dean Bortz, editor of Wisconsin Outdoor News. Pat Durkin is freelance writer and editor, president of the Wisconsin Outdoor Communicators Association. Tim Isley, full-time freelance writer and photographer, taking a look at all things outdoors in Wisconsin. And if you have a question, a comment, or experience to share, I hope you'll join in. The number is 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. And before we go back to the spring hearings, I want to hear from Jane in Madison. Jane, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, when I was five, which was 75 years ago, I started duck hunting with my dad. And I got to be the dog because we didn't have one. So I got to be in the duck skiff and go get the ducks. But it really caused me to just love to be outdoors in marshes and wild places. And I always, through my long life, I've lived in a lot of rural areas. But now I live in Madison because we need the health care. And I've seen more animals, more wildlife since I moved to Madison than I ever did when I lived out in the country. We have sandhill crane and turkeys and deer, and there's spray peepers in a marsh that's 2 blocks away from my house. It's just amazing. I expected good things in Madison, but I've never expected that.
Oh, Jane, thanks a lot for calling. It brings up this whole area of wildlife in our urban areas, Pat.
Yeah, I earlier we were talking about turkeys in the urban areas and if they're causing problems or not. The one thing I learned as a kid, because we used to have a couple of chickens when I was growing up, and I lived on the west side of Madison. The thing I always advise people is do not back down and run away from a turkey when he's coming after you. If you run, they sense weakness in those male gobblers, those male turkeys. They can get nasty. They have spurs. They'll fly up and knock those spurs into you on their lower legs, and they can hurt you. And so if you run, you're just inviting an attack, basically. So the best thing you do is face them down, stand there, and don't run. But I think it's fascinating. Like where I live in Eau Claire, we have a little long little strip of woods that weaves through Eau Claire, and we happen to live on one little end of it. But in our neighborhood, you know, we've seen gobblers in the spring. I saw a gobbler cross Rudolph Street, which is a pretty main drag going through Eau Claire. He walked right across the crosswalk, and if I'd been fast enough with my iPhone, I would have recorded that, but you just had to take my word for it. I saw him coming down the sidewalk, and he walked right across to the crosswalk. But we also have deer, and it is fascinating, these animals, it's fun to see them. But like anything else, it can come at a cost. Whether it's car damage or anything else from hitting deer and turkeys. We don't have a whole lot of turkeys where I am, but I know I've read reports and talked to people who've had turkey problems where they roost where they don't want them to, and then their droppings can be a real mess to deal with, and they can cause various other damage. And raccoons, we have those. There's always something. And I just don't know what to tell people sometimes when they get mad about things, like whether it's woodpeckers beating on the wooden siding or whatever. I think, well, it's not all ferns and trilliums out there in the wild. So, sometimes we have to accept a little damage in the process.
Tim, I know you wanted to add something.
Just to add to what Pat said as far as seeing wildlife in the city. And my wife had a friend who sent us a photograph showing a sandhill crane standing on the sidewalk right beside a bus stop. It looked like the sandhill crane was standing there waiting for a Madison Metro bus to come right along.
Well, it gives folks an opportunity to see some animals, at least if they're not getting into the woods. A place like Madison or Milwaukee has one of the most extensive park systems and in the U.S. And you have a chance to go less than a mile practically from anywhere you are, I'm sure, in Milwaukee and land on a pretty nice park or wildlife area. It's a pretty good deal. Cindy in Middleton has something too before we get to those spring hearings. We'll get to those. Cindy, hi.
Hi. Well, as you probably know, the Midwest Crane Count is happening this Saturday.
Yep.
And my friend and I are doing it. And so everyone is given a location to stand for 2 hours. And so we went and spotted our location. And we found out that it is posted for turkey hunting starting this Saturday. Now, we have about a square mile in which we could be. And so the part that we looked at was the Black Earth Creek Sunnyside Unit. And we called up the warden, and he said, yes, this is a hunting area, so just be on the lookout. Well, and it was one of the better areas within the square mile that wasn't full of woods and wasn't super hilly. So do you have any, I mean, we're not going to do it there, but do we have to look for a place that is not posted, or can hunters go in other locations? How are we going? I mean, except to see people going around with guns wearing orange, do you have any tips for us?
That was this coming weekend?
This Saturday. It starts at 5:30 a.m. to 7:30 a.m.
Yeah. So,
that's interesting, because I'm wondering if they had that posted, if they had a disabled hunt. I know that sometimes when they have disabled hunts, they will post areas to let people know that there's disabled people who would be driving in with their vans or whatever, and or maybe hunting from a blind. But it's interesting that it would be a public area would be posted for turkey hunting. Normally, they don't post an area for turkey hunting. I'm not aware of that.
I'm not either, and the opening of the spring turkey hunt is April 16th.
Right, that's Wednesday the following week. So, but this weekend is the youth turkey hunt. So unless they have a youth turkey hunt going on there, but I don't know why they would post it if it's a public area.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm not sure either.
I'm wondering if you couldn't still go there, because there's probably... Yeah. Even with the youth season going on this weekend, there's probably not going to be many people out at all.
Right.
And if she's identified an open area, I would think she could still go there and
sure.
do the crane count.
Yeah, I would think so.
Yeah, I would think so as well. Cindy, I think if you're, you know, if it's got an open area, you can be, and you don't have to be right in the middle of the open area. You can be along the side of the open area with binoculars in your ears, of course, to hear those cranes. Well, I want to turn back to the spring hearings. Well, Pat, you recently wrote a column about the Wisconsin Conservation Congress, and I think in it you said you have a friend who thinks the organization is the worst idea Aldo Leopold ever supported.
I hear from a lot of people, and I think as a reporter, you like to have a wide network out there. But my friend, he has served on the Congress, and I know quite a few people over the years who served on the Congress, and he just doesn't think it was for him a good use of his time. And I guess my overall comment has been over the years that I have had my differences, which are in some cases pretty well known, with various, basically one chairman over the years, you know, 30-some years ago, who ran the Congress like a dictatorship, and I think that's no longer the case. And I guess my overall view, Larry, is that I like the Congress process. Yes, it frustrates everyone sometimes to see how slow things work, but I think that's that's not unique to the Congress. You know, our democracy was set up by our founding fathers to be a tough thing to get things through, and that when you have basically just pushing things through fast without a lot of review, mistakes happen more often. So I guess I've learned to appreciate the fact that it might take a while to get ideas through the Congress. It might be really frustrating, and there's things I would do differently. But overall, I like the fact that we have this annual get-together. We have this process we go through. We don't always win, but over time, I think it collects, it attracts a good number of good people who keep trying their best to make the system work. And so I will always encourage people to take the time to go online, look at that questionnaire. If they feel compelled, go to the hearings in person, vote for your delegates, you know, run as a delegate, run to be a delegate. And then if you get in, the only way you're going to change the Congress and make it even better is by getting in there and taking part yourself or working with people who are members. And that's my pitch to people is that if you don't like it, do something about it. Don't just, you know, quit and go off on the sidelines.
Makes a lot of good sense. And Dean, I know you've written about some of the rule changes that are proposed. I think some of the fish and game rule changes that are being proposed. Which ones are you tracking most closely?
As far as controversial issues, I don't think there are a lot of them, maybe even any of them this year. But the one that I found interesting is on the wildlife side of the DNR. And I think it's question number one. Yeah, I just scrolled to it. It's question number one, where the question would ask if we should leave non-edible parts of deer, bear, and elk in the field after harvesting if we butcher them in place. And after hunting out west a number of years ago, where we break down animals in the field, and when I say break them down, I mean we don't just quarter them. We bone them out and then package up, we put the meat in game bags and in a backpack, and we walk it out of there. So we got back here, and I hunt up north mostly, and some of them are some pretty big areas. So I thought, geez, why can't we do that here? So in the early 90s, I wrote a citizen resolution to allow us to bone out game in the field so that we didn't have to drag a deer from hell and gone. And, you know, and then just, you know, you could still take it in and register. You have the rack or you have whatever, you have the meat and everything. And I remember having to go to the Conservation Congress Big Game Committee to defend my position. And I go through all their rhetoric and tell them why we should do this. And at the end of it, I knew I was sunk when an old guy with blue and white striped overalls thumbs the suspenders and goes, wow, I can't think of anywhere in Wisconsin where I can't get to a deer with my tractor. I don't think we need this.
Oh, boy.
So it was sunk right there, and now here we have it in 2025.
And part of the ruling is to kind of allow people or entice people to go deeper in. And
I think it's related to CWD, you know, not bringing, you know, leave it, if just leave the stuff there, don't bring it out, and I think that's the point that they're trying to get to.
Yeah. Mike in Madison, on to you. Hi, Mike.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. A quick response to the lady who called. I'm worried about getting out in the woods during the hunting season. I'm an avid hunter. I tell all the people I run into out hiking their dogs or hiking in the woods that you have as much equal rights to being in the woods during hunting season as the hunters, and go make use of the woods. Just wear some bright colors and be aware that there might be hunters out there, but go have fun and enjoy the woods. But my question is related to the sandhill cranes. So I got a bunch of cranes hang out in my backyard here in Madison all the time and in the farm field across the street. And I know there's a proposed hunting option to hunt the sandhill crane because supposedly they're causing a mass amount of damage to the cropland. Now, the sandhill cranes that hang out in my backyard all summer long don't seem to do any damage. I don't see any damage in the farm field across the street where I take the dog for a walk. So I'm wondering, maybe your guest can tell me, what is all this talk about this massive amount of cropland damage? Now, I've seen turkeys land in cornfields and wipe out, you know, a 20-foot span of wingspans worth of rows, and I can understand that, but I just don't understand what the sandhill cranes are doing to damage as much cropland as being talked about out there.
Yeah, we discussed this, talked about this the last time. Tim, do you want to make a comment first?
Sure. I'll try and keep it to a short comment because I've got a long thought on this. But there, yes, sandhill cranes in the spring will come along, and when the new corn seedlings are just coming up, they will peck it, and then they'll just go right on down the row, and they will take that out. So there is a proposal. The main organization who was behind it was the Wisconsin Waterfowl Association, and some other hunting groups have been behind it. They want to open a hunting season in Wisconsin. Some other states out west do have hunting seasons. I'm a lifelong hunter. I do everything because I hunt. But to me, I'm not in favor of a sandhill crane season. It's a non-game bird. It's been that way since the early 1900s. I think a sandhill crane season is only going to divide hunters and non-hunters, and we don't need that. Not every state needs to hunt sandhill cranes. Like Nebraska has got thousands of sandhill cranes, and they don't hunt them out there. There have been some public surveys which have shown that, in general, people would prefer not to hunt season on sandhill cranes. The governor has put money in his budget to help offset farmers so that they could get this. There's a chemical called Avapel, which they can put on their corn seed, and it just makes it very unappetizing to sandhill cranes. So there are some things that they can do, but I think it's just a step in the wrong direction. What we need is to get hunters and non-hunters together to fund natural resources, because wildlife belong to everybody. And right now, only hunters and fishermen and trappers are the ones who are funding what the DNR conservation program is doing. If you don't have a license, you're not funding that. So we need to get them together to get funding from non-hunters. And I just think a sandhill crane season myself is not right for Wisconsin. Other states may have it, but I don't think we need it here in Wisconsin. But you're right. There are two bills in the legislature. I think it's 112 and 117, Assembly Bill and Senate Bill. And so they're going to have public hearings, and people should get out, and especially hunters who, like myself especially, I think, who disagree with it. I'm hoping that hunters will come out and voice their opinion. It's, you know, when game regulations are set, part of it is biological, the other part is sociological. So this is a social decision to be made.
And we can talk some more about that. Just a quick reminder, we're looking at all sorts of outdoor issues with our guests, Dean Bortz, Pat Durkin, and Tim Isley. I know Pat has some comments on the sandhills as well, and we'll get to those in just a minute. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at all things in the out-of-doors today with our three guests, Dean Bortz, Pat Durkin, and Tim Isley, all outdoor writers and editors. It's great to have them with us today. And you can join in. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to talk@wpr.org. And we were talking about the sandhill crane hunt. Pat, I know you had some thoughts on that as well.
Yeah, thanks, Larry. The first thing I'd say, unlike Tim, I would support a sandhill crane season. I think we could do it and show the public that hunting is a good recreation. It gets people out. We make use of these animals without causing harm to their populations. And this is one more species we could hunt safely and effectively. The other thing I point out is that I don't like to, I really dislike it when hunters and hunting groups use crop damage and damage in general as a reason to go out and open a hunting season or sustain a hunting season, unless we're going to be consistent. And the biggest problem in our state is deer damage. And yet, consistently over the years, we have not done a real good job of keeping the deer herd under control across the state. But the other thing I'd point out is that sandhill cranes are being killed in Wisconsin at a pretty high rate every year for crop damage. And I did an article a while back, and I found that during a six-year period from 2012 to 2018, our country killed nearly 10,000 sandhill cranes under crop damage permits. And none of those, and most of those were killed in Michigan and Wisconsin. Like over 9,000 of them were killed for causing crop damage in our states, two states. And not one of those sandhill cranes was allowed to be eaten because they were killed under a crop damage complaint. And they don't want to take a chance that people would start, you know, shooting these things as a food source. So they allowed them to be killed for causing crop damage, and then we have to destroy them. So I don't think that's a good use of a wild natural resource either. So it's a, to me, it's a real complicated issue, and I don't like to draw real hard lines in the sand and say we shouldn't cross that line, because I just don't think we have a real good biological reason to not have a sandhill crane season. And I think it'd be a good way to help educate people more about this crane, about these cranes and the good they do, and but also that they can cause some harm. But that's not why we hunt them. We hunt them because it's a good source of food, and that's my main interest in it.
I see in the spring hearings there is a proposal for a stamp for sandhill cranes, and that would, and the money from that stamp would go toward paying farmers for crop damage, if I'm not mistaken. Tim, you're familiar with that one, I think.
Right. It's a good question, and it's a proposal that has come up, and it would collect money, and it doesn't have anything to do really with the hunting season. It just says we'd have a stamp, and this would allow people to really contribute towards helping to pay for some of that crop damage. Of course, the crop damage occurs during the spring, and the hunting season that's been proposed is during the fall. So the hunting season really isn't going to do much for that crop damage. And Pat's got a good point there and talks about the sandhill cranes that are shot doing crop damage. But to me, the problem there is the law. Change it so that you'd allow these landowners who are shooting the sand to use the bird for meat. To me, that's the problem, but correct.
Let's take a different direction. Sheila's got one from Kewanee. Sheila, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. So when I was a kid, my dad told me that the federal government used to put some kind of chemical in the rivers to stop lamprey eels from going out into Lake Michigan. And I'm 61 now, and we have seen a lot of lamprey eels on the sport fishing that we're bringing in on our charter vessel out of Kewanee. And I'm wondering if you guys have any knowledge about what's going on with that.
Dean, let's turn to you for that.
Sure. We just ran something recently in the newspaper about this, and we'll be updating it as we go. So this sort of goes back to the pandemic period where, because of the COVID deal, a lot of functions that used to go on weren't going on during COVID. And so lampricides, the chemicals that were used to kill the eel, the lampreys, that slowed down or stopped. And so there actually has been an increase in lampreys in the Great Lakes and other areas. And right now we're trying to catch up. And the catch-up isn't catching up quickly enough. Eventually, you know, they'll hope to curb this a little bit, but they're going to have to really work hard at this over the next probably 3, 4, or 5 years to get the lamprey numbers back down, and then hopefully be able to maintain that without any interruptions in service on, you know, in this particular arena. So, yeah, you're going to see more lampreys for the time being.
But that process is now returned. I can remember when this first came up, when it just exploded all those years ago, and how that problem was really mitigated through the use, some good science and good research that came up with some solutions. And then we had to hold back on it for a while. And so now it's got, as you say, Dean, it's going to have to kind of start. It started up again, the process, but it's going to take some time to get those numbers back down for sure.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. It's too bad. But Sheila, at least there's some hope, long-term hope, at least for that. And thank you very much. Pat, did you have anything to add?
Yeah. The other thing I'd add, Larry, there have been, this is always an ongoing process when you have something you got to treat like this, when they go in and they spread these chemicals in these many tributaries across the Great Lakes where the sea lamprey spawn. And these lampricides, as they call them, are they basically kill the young lampreys while they're down in the muck of the bottom of these rivers and tributaries. And it's always an ongoing process because they find areas pretty regularly where they were spawning where they didn't expect them to be spawning, because we know that the water conditions change, the water clarity improves. It's always this ongoing need for good science, and that's one of the things I've talked about a few times in my writing, is that the whole idea of the lampricide treatments, the research was done back in the 1950s, and it took like, I think, 6-7 years of just sustained hard work trying to find one specific chemical that could target sea lamprey larvae and kill them and nothing else. And you think those kind of scientific projects require the sustained help from the government to get it done on our behalf. And so I'm always hoping that when people see budget cuts happening to our federal agencies and our state agencies, that they should realize that, well, you can cut these things, you can cut that budget, but you might pay for it and you might not like the results. So I'd be proceeding carefully with some of those kind of cuts.
Yeah, you wrote that the federal cuts are wreaking some havoc on our natural resources as well as PAD.
Right, yeah. What's happening is, I think, in Washington, D.C. is just really tragic. And I just got a notice from the National Wildlife Refuge System how hard hit they have been by these cuts. They, according to them, that 20% of the refuge staff have been lost since January. Through firings, deferred resignations, early retirements, and unfilled vacancies. And they were hearing that up to 40% of U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service staff could be lost by the end of April, or more, or because of early retirements and hiring freezes that are going on. So, 15 years ago, there were like 3,400 people managing the National Wildlife Refuge System, and today that number is closer to about 1,800, and it's falling. So these are treasures. I mean, national parks, national wildlife refuges. These are things that we're going to be losing. And even as buildings are vacated, and right now there's been a proposal for the Camas National Wildlife Refuge in Idaho to turn that over to the state of Idaho. So rather than being a national wildlife refuge, and some of these states out west don't like the public lands, and they're trying to get those public lands turned over to the state so that they can then sell them and develop them. And this is a really big concern, and people need to be concerned about what's going on.
We have a number of questions from emailers I wanted to get to as well. Rob emailed. This has to do with fishing. The forward-facing sonar has become increasingly controversial in Minnesota. It's increased pressure on muskie and panfish fisheries, and there is research underway in Minnesota to trying to quantify the impacts. Has forward-facing sonar become as controversial in Wisconsin, and is there any discussion on regulating it in Wisconsin, in our state? And Dean, maybe I'll go to you for that.
Sure. No discussion on, well, there are some discussions on regulating it, but it's at the ground level and among individuals, not agencies. And there was a last year that a muskie tournament, the tournament trail, they banned them. They banned forward-facing sonars. I'm almost afraid that the way the sonars work, by the time
Minnesota or any other entity that's researching this this topic, we might not have many fish left to protect once they decide once they find come up with some sort of findings. They're very effective.
So what do they do? I mean, what's the advantage of them? I'm sure people are wondering that.
Well, it's sort of like, okay, I can barely work a slip bobber, right? So I don't have a forward-facing sonar. But from what I've heard is that it's basically you put the transducer down and it's you can look out 75 feet, 100 feet in any direction. And the resolution is high enough so that you can identify what kind of fish you're looking at, whether it's a perch or a walleye or a muskie or a northern. Well, maybe not northern a muskie, but you can see it's a big esox. And then you can just walk over, tell your buddy, hey, walk over there, drill a hole. They're right, yep, right about there. I've watched some of this with friends who have the technology. It's really amazing what it shows you and tells you, whether it's open water or ice fishing, and it can get you right on the, it puts you right on top of the fish. In the past, if you're on a school and the school moves, you'd have to move around, drill a few holes, see if you find them again. Now you just, they're like a tiller handle. You just spin the transducer or camera, whatever it is. I guess it's transducer. And you say, oh, there they are. They moved over there, 50 yards. And so you can just go over and set up on them again.
And in casting for muskies, too, if you know right where to cast.
Well, whether this is true or not, I don't know, but 2 years ago, I heard that two young men who had the technology won a muskie tournament and made just 11 casts. Hmm. They didn't make a cast until they found a fish, and then they would cast to it and catch it, and that whether they caught, I don't know what they caught, three or four, but they won the tournament. So it's no longer, under this scenario, would no longer be the fish of 10,000 casts.
Yeah.
So I think it would have to come down to regulations. And the use of it is just getting rolling. I mean, more and more people do have it now, but it's still at a minor league level, but it's going to keep growing. And at some point, probably the only – we're not – I can't imagine we're going to be able to ban this. I just can't see that happening. And so it's going to come down to bag limits and size limits. You have to reduce them if it ends up impacting fisheries.
Yeah, I think I think you're right about that. I've never used them myself either. I've got, it's just sort of a standard one that shows you what's below you. And it takes the enjoyment out of it a bit. I'd rather not know. I'd rather throw my 10,000 casts. I've caught a lot of muskies in my day, and I was just fine for me the ones I've caught without that kind of assistance, for sure. Well, we're in the water, so let's go to Renata in Lake Mills next. Hi, Renata.
Oh, good afternoon. Thank you for the program. I'm calling about the topic of wake boats. These are quite big boats that create their own big wake so people can ski behind them or other water sports. And there's a lot of controversy about whether these are damaging to lakes or not. And my understanding is they're quite damaging. And people are buying the boats. And then because they have them, they think that there's no reason to ban these, especially on our inland lakes. And I live close to Rock Lake. They're talking about having a zone where people could go. But then the idea of who would enforce how many get on that little zone where the water is deeper, but it still disrupts the bottom and the sediments. I'll take my replies off the air, and thank you so much for your program.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Tim, you're nodding your head there. Let's go to you.
Well, I
first.
Think she's hit on a hot topic right now, and if you've followed the Natural Resources Board, at each of the last meetings, there's three or four people who are testifying during the citizen comment period about concern over wake boats. So it really is a concern, and the problem is that the state evidently cannot do anything. They don't have the regulations that they can enforce. You know, that it's possible that this is churning up the bottom, could be impacting some of the fish spawning. Also, it could be a danger. They put up this large wake, and if you've got canoes, kayaks, other things that are fairly close by, there's a safety concern there. Also, could be damaging some shoreline vegetation. So there is reason to be concerned, but the problem is that the state does not have the regulations that they can do anything about. And evidently, my understanding is that what it has to do is you have to have the local regulations, and the local township or the local lake district has got to put in the regulations, and that's the way it's got to go. But so people are really concerned about it, and it would be good for legislators to get on board and to do something to give the state the ability to regulate these, because there is a lot of concern about it. I think she's exactly right.
Thank you very much for that question and comment. Let's see, I was going to go to another question here that we have from the emailers. Lawrence emailed to say it was a long time back. There was a newspaper article about remnant populations of cougars. I guess we've discussed that. Scott emailed to say that they believe cougar traveling through Wisconsin went all the way to Connecticut and got hit by a car. And I believe that's the case as well. I think another one was hit in the Chicago area as well that had come through Wisconsin. Mary in South Range called but couldn't stay with us. Mary wants to know if people can vote on the Wisconsin Conservation Congress questionnaire online, and if so, when can they do that? Tim?
Well, sure. Exactly right. And again, going back to the Congress meetings, there's two separate things that go on here. One is the public meeting put on by the Conservation Congress. The other one are usually hearing questions, actual proposals by the Department of Natural Resources. But there are also questions by the Conservation Congress. So when this meeting takes place on Monday night, which I think it'll begin in each of the counties at 6:30, and they've got like a half hour, there's going to be some presentations by the DNR, and then there's going to be voting of the Congress delegates, at least two from every county, so people can vote on the delegates to represent them from their county. And then they'll have some of these questions that'll be there, and then people can vote that night, if like on their cell phone, but then it'll be open after that until I think the following Wednesday through April the 16th. People can use their computer or their cell phone, and they go to the questionnaire, and then they can vote on it, and so electronically, and then they'll tabulate all of those votes. For people who don't have a cell phone or aren't electronically connected, they can go to the meeting that night, and they will have a supply of 8 by 14 inch ballots available that people can mark then. And also, there'll be local resolutions that'll be submitted that night. So people should go to those meetings and be able to learn, vote for the people to represent them, and then they can vote electronically up until the April the 16th.
Steve in Stiles has a question for us, and we'll get to that in just a minute. A reminder, I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to WPR News. Taking a look at our Wisconsin Outdoors, and Steve has a question for us in Stiles. Steve, thank you for calling.
Yes, Larry, it's more or less a comment. I heard somebody talk about wake boats as I was driving, and I was at a meeting yesterday, and that subject came up, and another gentleman from another lake organization was saying that a township actually put an ordinance against wake boats because of an issue with ballast water. They take on ballast to make their wake, and then they'll move that boat from one lake to another. Well, you're taking that ballast water from one lake to another, letting it go somewhere. You're moving invasive aquatic species like Eurasian water milfoil. So that's how they got around that. That particular problem with the wake boats is that they don't allow them to take on ballast. That way,
if they can't take on ballast, they're not as effective or fun as what they're ever designed for. I don't know much about the boat, but I know that when they take on ballast water and you move it to another lake, that's how you move AIS around.
Yeah, it's a very good point. Dean, have you written about that?
Yeah, just a clarification on that. So the deal is they cannot completely empty those ballast tanks. And they might take on 70, 80, 90 gallons of water to add weight to the boat to make the wakes. So they'll go on, if they're trailered boats, so somebody's moving in between lakes, they'll put in their boat, suck up a bunch of water, ride around that lake that day. Legally, you can't leave a lake with water in your live well. If you're a fisherman, you have to drain your live well. So they also have to drain their ballast tanks. But there's no way. Those tanks are under the floorboards and the sidewalls. You can't tell how much water is removed. And you can, even if you're not pumping anything out of the boat, there's still water in those ballast tanks. You can move to the next lake, pull in some more water, rinse it around with the water that's left from the previous lake, spew it out when you leave that lake. You can see what's happening. Yeah, there's a great chance of moving aquatic invasive species around that way. Now, he said something that I'm not really clear about, and it sounded to me like he was saying that local township is saying that the wake boaters cannot take ballast water on board when they come onto the lake. Now, I'm not sure if I heard that right or not. I've not heard that one yet, but I've heard a bunch of other different types of local ordinances that people are trying to put in place. The problem being, like up here where I'm at, the Minocqua chain, you have at least 3, 4, possibly 5 townships attached to that lake. So each township could have a different regulation. Each township or town would have their own boat patrol officer, and you'd have to know where the township lines are at on the water in order to know whose ordinances apply in that sector and which boat patrol officer is going to work that area. Or like if it's on the Wolf River, for instance, or any big river, you're going up and down. You can move through several different municipalities, and each one could have different rules. And so it's not that the state can't do it. So far, the state legislators haven't had the will to put something in place at a state level that would make much more sense than having a bunch of different local ordinances.
Yeah, that's true. And again, Steve, thank you for calling. Appreciate it. One of Scott had emailed about gut piles with lead in them and reconsumed through the food chain. And I know there is one of the spring hearings proposal is to eliminate lead ammunition and lead fishing tackles, if I'm not mistaken. Tim?
Yes, that's one of the questions that is on for the Conservation Congress. And basically, they say that non-toxic bullets, shot, and fishing weights are widely available, and they're often comparable in price. And lead poisoning is preventable and can be eliminated. So they asked the question about, would you support phasing out uses of lead so that it is not left behind on our lands and in our waters? And it's really a good question. It's one of the questions that I'm really interested in, and I think it really makes a lot of sense. You know, I saw Carl Batha, retired DNR wildlife manager, put on demonstrations where he put together about 10 one-gallon milk containers filled with water and then shot them with a rifle bullet. And then you go ahead and you look in those plastic containers and you look at the lead fragments that are in there. So that lead is coming off the bullet, and that's getting in your venison. And if we're small game hunters, we're leaving lead pellets on the land for other birds to pick up. You can't use it for waterfowl. It's all non-toxic. So why not switch? It'd be good for the environment. It'd just be good overall. The question is, why not switch?
Yeah, it's one of the – I hope that one gets passed for sure. There's another one that allows the use of technology to tend traps. Dean, you had a comment on that one, I believe.
Well, it's just a question, I guess, is I was surprised to see that one on the list. I hadn't heard of it coming down the pipe. And I'm guessing that they have to be referring to the trail cameras that can send you photos via cell phone. That's got to be what that is, unless maybe it also means you could use a drone so that if you, for instance, park and the traps, your trap line is in a marsh, quarter mile in, half mile in, instead of walking in to check it, you could put up your drone and fly in there and find your set and see if there's anything in it. You know, I don't trap a whole lot, but I guess I just don't see. I mean, if you're a trapper, I think you'd want to go check your traps and just make sure that everything's okay. You know, and trappers have long been known as being some of the best woodsmen in our state, and that's because they get out and look at every little stinking piece of evidence that an animal might have gone through somewhere. And I would think we would erode that ability if we started using trail cameras to check traps.
Yeah, I think they there was something that will alert. There's sort of an alert mechanism that you can have that if there's something in the trap, you're alerted right away. So that was another part of it, I think.
So you're saying we may have smart traps? I had not heard about that.
Pat, do you want to comment?
Yeah, the biggest way they'd monitor it would be through a trail camera, you know, set up with the cellular service for when an animal triggers a picture, gets transmitted out, and then the person whose camera is watching that trap would be alerted. The thing, this question was brought up just last month at the annual conference of the Wisconsin Trappers Association. And as a group, they rejected it. They voted against it. The thinking among the trapping community overall is that they just don't think this is a good way to go. That, like Dean said, these are some of our best conservationists in the state are the guys and women who trap. And the collective thoughts seem to be that they really pride themselves on the amount of work that goes into running a trap line. And they don't like the idea of making that job easier. And the only justification most of them seem to have when I talked to them was they said there are services that are out there that trappers are hired to remove like a problem animal, something living in someone's attic or something, you know, something like a squirrel getting into the attic or a raccoon getting into the attic. And then they could, you know, set these trail cameras to monitor those kind of traps. So that there is that way of that'd probably be a good extra thing to have, and that's where it's been used the most. But they just don't want to have that become part of the natural, you know, the scene in the typical Wisconsin trap line.
And on that note, we are out of time, guys. I want to thank you so much for being with us today. We covered an incredible number, and I'm sorry we didn't get to all the emails and other calls, but I really appreciate your time. Dean Bortz, editor of Wisconsin Outdoor News, Pat Durkin, freelance writer and editor and president of the Wisconsin Outdoor Communicators Association, Tim Isley, freelance outdoor writer and private landowner in Crawford County, a founding member of the Wisconsin Outdoor Communicators Association, and we'll get them back and we'll do this all over again. And thank you for listening. This and all our shows are a team effort. Our producers, Clara Neipert, Joel Patnott, our technical directors, Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins, and our executive producer is Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller, and hey, stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.